We will know once they start that transit, and we will monitor it as they make their transit to Unalaska.
Shell's drill rig Kulik is cleared for towing to Unalaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski talks offshore revenue sharing to the Alaska legislature.
What our legislation will do is direct 27.5% of the revenues from all forms of offshore energy production to our coastal states.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The Coast Guard lifted an order restricting movement of Shell's Kulik drill rig this morning. Petty Officer David Mosley says the company had to provide information about assessments of the rig and their tow plan to the Coast Guard for review.
The inspection, its seaworthiness was done by industry class certification. They are the experts on those type of vessels. They inspected. They gave us their inspection for review so we can understand what they found, if there was any concerns or not that needed to be addressed prior to it being able to be transferred or transported from Kaluta Bay.
Now that the captain of port order has been lifted, Shell is free to start towing the rig whenever it sees fit. It's not clear when that will be, but Mosley says the Coast Guard will be notified.
We will know once they start that transit, and we will monitor it as they make their transit to Unalaska.
For now, the rig is anchored in Kaluta Bay on the south side of Kodiak Island. That's where two of the tugs that will be towing the Kulik to Unalaska collided on Friday afternoon. While working in close proximity, the Corb and Foss ran into the port side of the Ocean Wave. Petty Officer Mosley says there were no injuries and the damage was minimal. But the Marine Safety Detachment in Kodiak inspected both vessels.
When we have an incident with reported damage that could impact the vessel, we will, as the Coast Guard, want to ensure the safety of that vessel and the crew on board. So we will provide an inspection and an investigation into the incident to include things like drug testing of the crew, taking down statements of what was going on at the time. So we get a clear understanding of what was going on to see if there was anything that might need to be addressed in the future with similar operations.
The Ocean Wave is still tied up at the dock in Kodiak. The Corb and Foss is with the rig in Kaluta Bay. The scope of Alaska's sex trafficking problem remains unclear, but there's plenty that can still be done to help victims. That's the conclusion of a report issued by a state task force charged with studying the issue. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has more.
Over the past few months, a team of state officials and nonprofit workers have been trying to figure out the extent of sex trafficking in both urban and rural Alaska. They went out to Anchorage and Bethel and Hooper Bay, and they learned about what makes a young person vulnerable to trafficking and heard about how most of the state's shelters don't have the resources to deal with victims. But even with all the testimony and research they did, it was still a struggle to quantify the number of Alaskans coerced into prostitution. Alaska courts have only made about 20 sex trafficking convictions over the past 6 years. Attorney General Michael Garrity was part of the trafficking task force, and he says that's because by its very nature, the problem is underground.
It's beneath the surface, and the fact that we can't get more hard data on it doesn't mean it does not exist.
The task force was mostly left with anecdotes when they talked to shelters and social service organizations across the state, and a report they issued this month speaks of both gaps in information and gaps in services. But the anecdotes that the task force heard were, in their words, heartbreaking. Gwen Adams, a pastor of women's ministries at the Change Point Church in Anchorage, served on the task force, and she told her own story about trafficking before a legislative committee on Wednesday. Adams described a woman she had known who had been coerced into prostitution by a family who was supposed to be fostering her. When she learned this, Adams wanted to know if the woman was participating against her will.
She said, "No, I have a choice." And I said, "Well, what happens if you would, if you would refuse. She said, well, I would be beaten, I wouldn't get to eat, and I would be locked in a closet for days. So how do you have a choice? Well, I can choose to be beaten, or I can choose to have sex. But completely unaware of the fact that she was being trafficked or a victim, she just felt like these were her circumstances in life and had no way out.
The task force came up with about a dozen ways to help the woman described and others like her. In their report, they advocate for more short and long-term shelters, and they say they would like to see prosecutors and social workers trained to better recognize trafficking victims. They also said that Alaska's laws should be strengthened so that the state could subpoena websites where solicitation occurs, like Craigslist. The task force also suggested that the legislature might consider changing the law so that trafficked prostitutes could have their records expunged. Attorney General Michael Garrity says a provision like that would make it easier for trafficking victims to find jobs and secure housing.
If you're a victim like that, you should have an opportunity to clear your record and be able to return to gainful society.
An expungement law for trafficking victims exists in a handful of other states. The task force's work is complete with this report, but they've asked the state to create a permanent working group to implement these recommendations and continue studying the issue of sex trafficking. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she'll soon introduce a revenue-sharing bill for offshore energy production. Speaking to the Alaska State Legislature this morning, Murkowski said she's still working out final details of the bill with Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu.
We realized that an Alaska-only bill is not going to pass Congress. So what we wanted to do was focus on the national perspective. So what our legislation will do is direct 27.5% of the revenues from all forms of offshore energy production to our coastal states.
She says the plan goes beyond offshore oil and gas projects, and that could help sway skeptical lawmakers in Washington.
If you have offshore wind, if you have ocean energy, that these would also be part of our revenue sharing proposal. We offer an additional 10% of revenues if states establish funds for clean energy and conservation projects.
Her plan, as she outlined today, differs from other revenue-sharing bills. Senator Mark Baggage introduced his own earlier this month that would give the states 37.5% of offshore oil and gas revenues. Murkowski says if the plan were implemented, it could lead to billions of dollars in new revenue for the state. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly looks at a controversial ordinance on unions.
I think we're going way too fast in what I call a major revision of this code, and I would like to see it postponed for a long period. We've got some major issues before us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A measure that would require voters to show photo identification at the polls got its first hearing today. Representative Bob Lynn, a Republican from Anchorage, sponsored the bill, and he views it as a simple way of preventing voter fraud.
We need photo ID to buy booze, to enter a federal building, at the airport, for some banking operations, to drive your car, to get a passport, to buy cigarettes, for a certain test taking, at some workplaces, to enter federal building, and more.
If a person doesn't have photo ID available, they would have to show two alternative forms of identification, like a birth certificate or tribal organization card. A person could also be okay to vote if they are recognized by two election officials. If a voter doesn't meet any of these requirements, then they have to cast a question ballot. During the hearing, the director of the Alaska Division of Elections answered questions about the mechanics of the bill and number of cases of voter fraud that Alaska has seen. She said the state had experienced very few cases and that those would not have been prevented by the proposed law. Questions were also raised about the effect the proposal would have on the bush and whether it would be constitutional, with representatives from the Association of Village Council Presidents and the American Civil Liberties Union speaking against the bill. Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Republican, also commented that some of her constituents from Wasilla have raised concerns about the bill.
It's not uncommon for them to go to the polls, going to people that they know in our small community, either knowing somebody or pulling out a fishing license or a hunting license, but not necessarily traveling with two pieces of ID. And they just find this very, very cumbersome, especially since we don't really have that problem of voter fraud.
Nearly a dozen states currently have photo ID laws in effect. Attorneys representing labor unions made a presentation to members of the Anchorage Assembly at a work session at City Hall yesterday. They outlined their concerns about an ordinance to limit unions that was recently proposed by Mayor Dan Sullivan. The mayor also launched a media campaign supporting his proposal. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
As you flip through the radio dial, you may hear a new radio ad by Mayor Dan Sullivan.
Leaders of the Anchorage Assembly and I recently introduced the Responsible Labor Act, an ordinance that will improve the way future labor contracts are negotiated. The ordinance does not eliminate.
Ordinance 37 was proposed less than 2 weeks ago. The Anchorage Assembly is now reviewing it. The ordinance would impact approximately 2,200 municipal employees, from accountants to police officers and firefighters. It limits pay, benefits, and mediation, and eliminates the option of a strike. But its centerpiece is the introduction of managed competition, a process by which a public agency competes with private firms to provide public services. The mayor says fire and police departments, as well as emergency services, would be exempt. The competition in other departments, though, he says, would save the municipality money and make public employees more efficient. Attorneys representing unions disagree. They say the wording of the ordinance is too vague and gives the mayor's office too much power. Justin Roberts is the general counsel for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 1547.
It has conflicting terms throughout. It suffers from basic lack of definitions. It removes power from the assembly. It gives virtually unchecked power to the Employee Relations Board to interpret the terms of this ordinance.
Robert says members of the Employee Relations Board are appointed by the mayor, so the setup is political and problematic. He and the other two attorneys representing unions were especially concerned about the lack of a clear definition for managed competition. Assemblymember Jennifer Johnston admits that the definition needs some sharpening. She says she's been advocating for managed competition since she was elected nearly 6 years ago. This is how she attempted to explain it.
You are saying to the service center, the public sector service center that has the employee in it, how much would it cost for you to do this? This is what it is outside your unit. How much is it going to cost? This brings the employee and management together to form a team to say we can do it better.
Johnston says she plans to introduce an amendment with a clearer definition for managed competition soon. Assemblymember Paul Honeman says he's doubtful that managed competition is the way to go. But he says the bottom line is that the process needs to slow down.
I think we're going way too fast in what I call a major revision of this code, and I would like to see it postponed for a long period. We've got some major issues before us.
Honeman says there's no need to push to get the new law in place before union negotiations begin at the end of March or the beginning of April, as the mayor wants. Honeman says the negotiations can always be extended. Several assembly members expressed concern that the ordinance could make the assembly responsible for the ultimate decision on which contracts to go with. Although Assembly Chair Ernie Hall helped introduce the mayor's proposed ordinance, he also has concerns.
The way it's currently stated is it comes down to the assembly. And there's a number of us that if we can figure out a way to make that be absolutely the last resort, it could be very political to handling that. And what we're doing is we're really trying to put thought into this where we end up with something that works really well for a long time into the future. And you're not worried about who's in charge.
As the proposed ordinance stands, the mayor's office would gain significant power over how labor is managed. Hall says he anticipates an amendment addressing that issue. Public testimony on Ordinance 37 begins Wednesday, February 27th, at the LUSAC Library Assembly Chambers at 6 o'clock. The Wilda Marsden Theater will also be open to accommodate the expected crowd, with video from inside the Assembly Chambers. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Association of Village Council Presidents would like its tribes to be able to prosecute non-tribal members in their local courts. As Angela Denning Barnes reports from KYUK in Bethel, tribal leaders want more authority under the Violence Against Women Act.
The Violence Against Women's Act that is making its way through Congress has the support of AVCP for the most part. However, the Native nonprofit organization, which represents 56 tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region, is opposing part of the legislation, the part that doesn't allow Alaskan tribes to prosecute non-tribal members. That's a sticking point for AVCP President Myra Nanning.
Why do they always have to have an exclusion for non-tribal members? The tribal court should be able to deal with all people who live in the village.
Reauthorizing VAWA has passed the Senate and will be considered by the House next. It does allow tribes on reservations to prosecute non-tribal members for domestic violence that occurs within their borders. However, in Alaska, there is only one reservation, Metlakatla in Southeast, so other tribes in the state would not have that right. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted for the bill, saying she made sure Metlakatla was treated no different than other reservations in the country. She said for the state's other tribes, she focused on language that confirms that they have the power to issue domestic violence protective orders against their own members.
So what this does is simply maintains the status quo.
Murkowski also included language to reestablish the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission, which has the tribes, state, and federal governments working together on rural safety issues. In the YK Delta, there are about 20 tribal courts, but the state court still deals with most crimes region-wide. Nanning says access to state courts is difficult for some villages because they're so remote, sometimes hundreds of miles away.
How much does it cost to go from one of the villages to Bethel to go to court, especially from Lower Yukon? Like, it's probably over $1,000 round trip.
Giving tribal courts more leverage to deal with crimes would help, he says. Tribal courts can use traditional forms of resolution, such as peace circles or even banishment, a form of punishment for people who consistently cause problems in a community. Nanning says tribes should be able to exercise that with non-tribal members as well.
I think that the village should have the ability to ban these people from their communities, which has been done and is still going on today.
Nanning says AVCP would like to see changes made to the Violence Against Women's Act in the House, and they plan to work with other tribes in Alaska to lobby for that. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska's oil wealth portfolio has hit an all-time high, $45 billion. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation announced the fund hit the mark on Tuesday. The corporation tracks the fund daily. CEO Mike Burns said hitting $45 billion is a sign the Alaska Permanent Fund has not only regained ground lost during the recession, but also that it is growing. Burns says the fund, by any measure, has been very successful. He says the patience Alaskans have had in growing the fund is extraordinary and says it takes a lot of political will to keep the fund off limits for use on other things. Since 1977, the corporation says the fund has received more than $16.5 billion in mineral royalties and general fund appropriations and paid out $19.8 billion in dividends. The village of Tuluksak regained power early this morning after a two-day outage. KYUK's Mark Earhart reports it required the help of the Alaska Energy Authority to finally get the lights back on.
The lights went out in Tuluksak around 4 p.m. Monday when its only generator stopped running.
The water pump overheated and stopped.
Willie Phillip, Tuluksak's power utility manager, says the village received another generator engine just yesterday. That engine came from the Alaska Energy Authority's Emergency Response Program.
And what we were able to do is locate an engine for one of their generators to get it back online. We diverted one of our remote maintenance workers who was in the area, and we sent him over to Tuluksak.
Sandra Moeller is the Deputy Director of Rural Energy at AEA. She says the Energy Response Program was implemented for emergencies just like this one.
Typically for when a community is basically gone dark.
Phillips says the village's backup generators were non-functioning as well, so the new engine was vital.
We got it online about 2 o'clock this morning or 2:30 somewhere.
He says after a few cold nights, Tulixac residents were happy to have the lights and heat back on.
Calling me and my co-workers.
But he says the power wouldn't have come back without help from community volunteers helping to transport and install the new engine. In the future, the AEA may be able to help villages like Tulixac with yet another program.
Called the Rural Power System Upgrade Program, and we've just completed a 6 or 8 month process of evaluating all power plants in rural Alaska.
She says Tulixac and other rural villages in need may qualify for assistance through the program, pending legislative funding. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Alaska House of Representatives has come out against genetically engineered salmon, or as critics call it, frankenfish. Representatives unanimously approved House Joint Resolution 5 yesterday. It urges the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to reconsider a preliminary finding that genetically modified fish would not significantly impact the environment. The resolution also urges the agency to require labeling for GM salmon if the product is ultimately approved. The legislation was sponsored by Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr. She says genetically engineered fish has not been proven safe.
The resolution opposes this move for three reasons. Threats to wild salmon stocks, threats to human health and consumer confidence in wild Alaska salmon, and potential negative economic impact on our wild seafood industry.
The House joins the Parnell administration, the state's congressional delegation, and thousands of Alaskans represented by seafood industry groups in opposing genetically modified fish. The resolution now goes to the state Senate. Massachusetts-based biotech company Aqua Bounty petitioned the FDA to approve the genetically engineered fish, an Atlantic salmon with genes from a Chinook salmon and an eel-like fish, to make it grow faster. The company has spent nearly $70 million since forming in 1991. The FDA recently extended the public comment period on Aqua Bounty's petition through April 26th. The state of Alaska has a problem with derelict vessels, and lawmakers in Juneau are looking at how to address it. Municipalities would be given greater authority to deal with derelict and abandoned vessels under a bill introduced by Homer Representative Paul Seaton. Seaton introduced HB 131 yesterday. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Last Thursday, the Fisheries Committee in the Alaska House of Representatives heard information about the growing number of derelict fishing and other vessels in the state of Alaska. Wynn Minifee is the Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. He says derelict vessels are found on beaches and shorelines across the state, as well as sunk in the nearshore environment.
We have a lot of stuff that ends up on either shorelands or tidelands that's either abandoned or in poor order.
Minifee noted that any vessel that is anchored in place for over 14 days in state-controlled waters needs a special permit. But he admits that enforcement is lacking in state law.
We don't actually have a very effective means of enforcement authority to, and we don't have any sort of ability to fine somebody if they violate this. And so right now, when we find somebody that does go beyond that 14-day limit, we have to try to get them under authorization, but that can be quite a challenge to do.
Often it's cheaper and more economical for owners to simply scuttle or abandon a derelict vessel. And even if those vessels are sunk at sea, they often wash up on beaches. Currently, DNR has a backlog of 94 vessels on state land, but those are just the vessels formally identified. Minifee confirms that does not count the large number of vessels that have not yet been identified because they are below the waterline or located in unpopulated areas.
Because just about every time we go out and do field investigations of any larger scale, we find more abandoned vessels.
If a vessel needs to be removed or cleaned up, It can be very expensive, and Menifee divulged that the recent effort to remove two vessels that sank in Jackaloff Bay and Lower Cook Inlet cost about $250,000. Representative Paul Seaton is the chair of the House Fisheries Committee.
We're trying to see if there's something we can do in statute to give the departments and get a coordination to proactively work to prevent these sinkings and very expensive operations that have to take place for the state.
Back in October, the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators passed a resolution requesting stronger municipal powers in regards to abandoned and derelict vessels, and that request is being supported by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, which was represented at last week's meeting by Michael Lukshin. He's the state ports and harbors engineer. He stressed that the issue of derelict vessels in Alaska is not going away anytime soon.
There are many older, less efficient boats that are still floating, especially wooden boats. Many of these boats have been removed from fishing due to the rationalization programs, and this problem will not go away.
Another of those who testified Thursday was Carl Yucatel. He's the vice president of the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators. He's also the port director for Juneau. Yucatel called for an update to the statutes on the books related to derelict vessels by giving local municipalities some of the same powers the state has to deal with abandoned and derelict vessels.
This proposed authority is necessary throughout the state, but especially in smaller coastal communities where legal and enforcement resources are not readily available to deal with the liabilities and hazards of abandoned and derelict vessels. The construction and operations of harbors by the Alaska Department of Transportation shortly after statehood resulted in regulations which empowered only ADOT to effectively deal with troublesome vessels. Expanding the language to include not only ADOT, but other state agencies and municipalities would appear to be sound legislation.
In his weekly legislative update, Fisheries Committee Chairman Paul Seaton from Homer noted that the derelict vessel issue is growing and is one that needs to be addressed to save the state money and to protect people and the environment. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyson on Alaska, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Speck is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Join in the excitement and the love of art at the Alaska Public Television Art Auction. Take a look at the paintings, drawings, mixed media, and sculptures from Alaskan artists online at alaskapublic.org. Be sure to watch KAKM Channel 7 for the Alaska Public Television Art Auction starting Thursday night from 7 until 10. And join us in the studio Friday and Saturday. All proceeds benefit KSKA, APRN, and Alaska Public Television. Information at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.